Hello and welcome to the 361 Podcast, Season 9, Episode 2. My name's Ben Smith from Wireless Worker.
I'm Ewan from Mobile Industry Review.
And I'm Ray from the All About Sites.
This week we're talking about smart living, specifically the value of adding smart devices into our lives, the ecosystems these things will exist in, and whether or not we should trust this stuff.
So sensors and connectivity everywhere, in the home, in the car, in the public realm.
And we're going to talk about how all that will play nicely.
Welcome back, gents.
Hello.
Hello, Rafe Blanford.
Hello, everybody.
How are you doing?
Yeah, how are you feeling, man?
I'm feeling tip-top.
I thought he was going to say tipsy.
Tipsy. There we go. Right, Rafe Blanford's looking very relaxed this evening, actually.
Why are you feeling relaxed? Tell the audience.
Because I've just had 4 chocolate eggs.
Ah, yes. The famous 361 podcast pre-recording snack has tanked Rafe Blanford up with chocolate.
He's having Dime Bar. Dairy milk, eggs. Yeah,
there we go. So that's sort of part of the dairy milk, part of the Cadbury range that Kraft Foods haven't ruined. That's a little confectionery joke for all you UK listeners out there. Everyone else would just be not caring about that.
How are you feeling?
I'm weary. As we record this, I am days away from the arrival of my first child. And I'm not entirely sure. If not having had the child makes me this anxious and sleepless, I'm not sure what having the child is going to do to me.
Yeah, just triple it.
Yeah, I'm quite tired, so quite weary, but we'll try and be high energy this evening. Rafe Blanford, are you all right?
I think you just asked me that, Ben, so you definitely are feeling tired.
Oh, there we go.
I just don't think I got an answer.
I do agree. He blanked us. Yeah. Go on. Tell us what's happening. What's new in your life?
Well, I bought myself a Microsoft Surface Pro 3, as I give away absolutely nothing about my private life and just talk about my gadgets.
Fair enough. That Rafe's life is a closed book.
And actually, I'm really enjoying it. It's kind of one of those two-in-one devices transforming between kind of a laptop-like device and a tablet. And I think Microsoft have done a really good job on this. I'm finding it really great for having a portable, powerful computer with me all the time. Certainly one up on an iPad, although I will say it doesn't have the kind of versatility in terms of apps and entertainment that an iPad does.
You still have to
does.
Think about it, don't you?
It's not so much thinking about it. It's just based around productivity and work and as a browsing tool. It doesn't have those whole range of games. That's really all about the what's available in the respective app stores.
Right. Well, I'd like to say hello to the listeners because I just don't think you guys do a good enough job of doing that.
Fair enough.
Well, I think you just broadcast at them rather than speaking to them.
Fair enough.
So hello, listeners. Hello, listener. It's really nice to have you. Please enjoy this upcoming broadcast to you.
Right, there you go. Ewan McLeod playing Man of the People this week. So, Rafe Blanford, what are we talking about this week?
Well, this week we thought we'd talk about smart living, which is a pretty broad topic.
So that's me all over, that is.
That is, Ewan McLeod, smart living. He's wearing a waistcoat this week, listeners, talking about as people are
Do you like it? Look, it's got a special... I'm going to stand up so you can see it properly.
There's a particularly fetching yellow, black and blue tie, and he's got a very nice dapper waistcoat. I mean,
it's a double-breasted waistcoat.
There we go.
Thank you, John, Taylor John.
There we go. So smart living, we don't mean tailoring, though, of course. We mean houses and homes and, well, what do we mean, Rafe Blanford?
Well, actually, it's really about adding smartness and connectivity to everyday objects that are around you or on you all the time. So this can be quantified self. We did wearables last season. That can be contributing to smart living. We could also think about smart homes. That's putting in appliances that are smart or adding sensors into your home. We also, I think, could cover it into connected cars. Uh-huh. But also wider than that, kind of the smart public realm. And we talk about the smart grid and the smart city. That's all part of smart living. And arguably, it sort of extends to pretty much anywhere where there's humans and objects that interact with each other.
And should we be calling this just connected living rather than smart? Because smart does smart with me.
I think connected is just the enabler and smart is kind of what you get out of it. And that's actually the bit that matters.
Right. But I don't know if I've seen anything that I would class as very smart, though.
Well, that's
kind of the point.
That is a good point, isn't it? Because a year or maybe 2 years ago, I forget, and apologies, listeners, the GSMA were doing connected living at Mobile World Congress. That was their big theme, wasn't it? Mm. And they showed a lot of context, but they seemed to sort of talk in one breath about how the connection was going to make everything better and then gloss over a little bit about the huge complexity of actually making everything talk to everything else and standards and
connections. Well, because there was a fundamental assumption that you'd be putting a SIM card in everything.
Well, there was that assumption, but also just that thing of, well, look, we gave you a pipe between these two things. Everything else is simple. Crack on, you know.
Well, it was this idea, really, of the connection is what did it, but actually you just get singular objects as a result of that. And so you had the smart toothbrush that didn't really do anything apart from give you some stats about brushing your teeth. And you had the smart light bulb that you had to make an effort to turn on with your phone. And so I think it's very important to emphasize that it's only when you start combining things together and have the objects talking to each other that you really get smart living. Before that, it's just really connected living. And frankly, the value of being able to turn things on over Wi-Fi from a smartphone, and actually one of the interesting points about this is there is a massive assumption that it's all done via a smartphone. That's kind of the control point, which, given that smartphone penetration in some markets is still relatively low globally, it's just gone over the sort of 55% barrier, that, you know, so there is already an addressable market that is somewhat limited. But as I say, it's kind of that collectiveness of all of these things. We talked about the cars, the self, the home,
right, so, okay,
that combine together smart living, but we haven't got there yet. And so there's this question of how do you unlock the value?
At Christmas, or for Christmas, my wife bought us those scales, the
Aria Fitbit.
The Aria, the Fitbit Aria, because I've got the Fitbit, so she went and got the Aria scales. So that's great. Every morning I can go in, I can stand on it, and it'll tell me my weight. It'll buzz me.
Says one person at a time, please.
Thanks very much. Actually, I'm looking very, very healthy.
You are. Right, you okay. are. Sickeningly so.
Thanks. And it's been a lot of work in the gym. By the way, I've lifted 97 kilograms.
I don't know what that
means. That's basically me-ish. Right. I mean, it's a little bit more. I'm a little bit more than that.
So still a while off being the world's strongest man at the Gibraltar competition.
This is true, but, you know, I have got these scales, right? We'll bring it back to reality here, right? And the only benefit is that when I step on them, it tells me what I want to know anyway, right? And it just updates my Fitbit app.
I thought you were going to say updates my Facebook.
Manually.
Well, you can have that option. Because I was doing it manually before. I was manually, you know, so it saved me. That is not smart. It's convenient, but it's not smart. So at what point do we get to smart? Is smart when the house switches the heating on because it knows I'm coming back home? Or, I mean, I don't even think that, I don't view that as smart either.
Well, there's different levels of it, but I mean, this is the important point. You know, how do you define the value from this?
Yeah, so we sort of looked at these and we thought, well, actually, if we can't talk just about all these different categories, that's too broad and it's a little bit too hard. So what we're going to do is we're going to look at three key topics, and that is value, ecosystems, and crucially for, well, my interest, privacy and trust. So let's talk about value for the moment then, because the key thing here is that clearly the big players out there in the world think that there is a lot of money to be made in this, and you can tell that because of all the acquisitions and takeovers that have been going on. Now, just before we come to that, obviously Apple announced HomeKit to be an industry standard at CES. Rafe's CES klaxon should be sounding now. So they've announced it as the core of their smart home initiative, but they're building it from the ground up.
Right.
Looks to me.
In a very Apple way. I mean, they've just had the latest regulations and rules come out about HomeKit and how they'll allow it to bridge to other systems. And actually, it is very typically for Apple quite controlling. There's an emphasis on security and trust, which might be a good thing, but it probably does mean that the sort of HomeKit home is going to take a few years to arrive because it's going to require manufacturers to go through the same MFI Apple kind of certification processes for other accessories. You're right, it's worth saying there's a couple of these systems. I mean, Google effectively has its own thing with Nest, and that is becoming an ecosystem in itself. Samsung bought SmartThings last year.
Yeah.
There's also some effectively existing standards out there which are starting to become more interesting. I mean, Z-Wave, which was the one that's all dominant in the US, was really around the early bits of smart automation or home automation. And as a result, it's actually a bit underpowered in terms of what it can do for the remote, the radio stuff, and particularly around privacy and security, which is why Zigbee has come to the fore. And that's actually kind of a standard wireless radio designed for kind of this home automation system.
I was a bit surprised at the value. So the one that stands out to me here is Google bought Dropcam, which is the How do you say? Yeah, I was going to say, because it's kind of mostly cameras, isn't it? But cameras for security. $555 million. I mean, that's a pretty substantial acquisition for what is a sort of a glorified internet camera business with a bit of software over the top. But I think it suggests that they're trying to build out more than, as you suggested, Ray, that more than just, you know, kind of the devices themselves. They're trying to build out ecosystems of you know, that includes a network connection, a style of wireless networking, a type of hub, you know, the endpoints, accessories, the whole thing.
And we should be fair to Dropcam in the sense that they were also looking to be a hub or a control point for the smart home. It wasn't just a connected camera. And a lot of their value was around some of the algorithms and the processing that they did in order to identify whether there are strangers in the house or out of the norm behavior. Just as with Nest, I mean, yes, it's a nice thermostat, and yes, it's a nice smoke alarm in its various guises. But the really interesting bit of it is the data and the stuff that sits kind of is invisible, if you like, that is doing the control for other things. And we'll touch on Nest, I guess, a little bit more later.
You know, a friend of mine, here's a wee story for you. A friend of mine put a drop cam in his house, went off on honeymoon, and just thought he'll just check, you know, log back in, see what's going on. Found his cleaner was stealing from him by a drop cam.
Wow. There we go.
There you go.
So
she said, no, he just showed her the videos.
Yeah. So it's
pretty worrying.
It's
but, you know, really smart. Yeah.
I was interested as well, just that mention of kind of the hub piece, Rafe, because Nest looks like Nest is building out this kind of hub idea, and they've got kind of partner agreements with, here we go, I'll read it off the list, pretend I know it, LG, Withings, Philips. There's kind of a works with Nest kind of program, which is quite cool. But they're kind of trying to build like sort of one small core set of products, and they're not really talking about a hub. Whereas Google, in parallel, also bought Revolve, didn't they? Which was just a product that was just a hub, you know, and you bought it to integrate all of your smart devices.
Now, I'm challenged here because this is all very interesting. But I want to know when I get it. When can I get it? When should I get it? And if I've already bought a Nest, so I know quite a lot of people have bought a Nest. Have I bought the wrong one? When is this decision going to be made by the market so I can get on with it? Because at the minute, the most I've invested is actually via Fitbit.
Yeah.
That's my smart home supplier at the moment.
I mean, I think we should talk more about Nest in the ecosystems, and actually the whole ecosystem thing is really about a battle of the hubs.
Yeah,
I mean,
so when is that going to be over, though?
I think it's going to take a while because it's a very nascent industry, essentially, and this is what all these acquisitions are demonstrating. And so when we talk about value, it's sort of all the building blocks are being put in place now, and that's why there are companies being exchanged for large amounts of money, because they recognize this is a big and growing industry. And if you look at the sort of numbers, it says by 2018 it's going to double in size and then double again after that.
I buy that, but can you give us an idea on the kind of revenue potential here?
It runs into the tens of billions of pounds.
Okay, all right. I'm thinking, because I was hearing, for example, like the rush hour concepts,
so,
right?
So, I mean,
there is real money being made here, not just whacking hardware at people.
This is when you talk about concrete value when it comes to the smart home. There's this whole idea of smartness making your life more convenient, but a lot of it comes down to, can it actually make life better by cutting the costs? And this is where Nest's rush hour program is really interesting. You can opt to have your smart thermostat turn down the heating for you, or potentially turn off an appliance, and thereby you get a rebate from your electricity company. And rush hour periods happen at peak energy demand, and it's a way for the energy company to kind of smooth out the demand curves. So, you know, as a customer,
so they automatically switch off one of your devices,
Absolutely, and it might be just turning the heating down by a few degrees. It might be turning your freezer off for 10, 15 minutes, and that won't have any effect on the appliance, and it may mean the house is just a little bit colder. But if that's something you're willing to accept, you will then get a rebate from the energy company, and it can be as much as sort of $80 a quarter. But the really interesting bit from a business model and value point of view is Nest is also getting a kickback from that. They get about $40 per customer who signs up to this rush hour program.
Wow.
And I think people tend to think of smart home just in the benefit to the consumer. There is one there.
Well, that sounds like a considerable benefit.
But actually, the bigger benefit is to these companies being able to innovate on business models, and also for the energy company itself, the savings offered by having these collective behaviors across, you know, this macro behavior of having everyone turn off their fridges when the World Cup game ends because they know that everyone's going to turn on the kettle, and thereby they flatten that energy demand spike. What that means is they don't have to spin up another gas-powered power station in order to meet the electricity demand, and that is offering huge savings on the infrastructure level.
And these devices, because let's say Nest, for example, that because you've got a Nest on your wall, the energy company, you can do a deal where it turns your perhaps your heating off, as you said, Rafe, but also they could collect details about your energy usage over time. So actually part of the economies could be around them having much more accurate data with which to predict demand in the first place.
And that's really what the smart grid is all about. It's that having much better ability to predict what's going to happen. Of course, they can tie that in with external data feeds about temperature, and they're already doing that, but it's the accuracy with which they can then do that becomes a lot greater. And so when we talk about smart living, it's actually as much about kind of smart infrastructure as anything else.
Okay, well, let's talk about that then, because it's pretty important. If this stuff's going to work well, it's all got to talk to each other, and it's all got to intercommunicate. And I'm a bit of a loss as to how that's going to happen with all these different commercial standards and products out there.
Okay, so there is a certain amount just on standards. We've got the All Join All Seen Alliance. That's an important way of kind of having these basic standards. I mentioned Z-Wave and Zigbee, but I actually think it's more helpful to think about it in ecosystem terms, because the standards will just happen, just as they have in other areas of technology. And actually, there's going to be a lot of effort on bridging the various different compromises. And we're already seeing that with different types of radio. Some are going over the cellular network, some over Wi-Fi, some over Zigbee, some over proprietary standards. That doesn't matter. What matters is, will they talk to each other? So several approaches, hardware, software. Let's concentrate on hardware to start with. We've already mentioned Nest. Mm. The Work with Nest program was getting an awful lot of attention at CES.
So I understand what you're saying there, but the connecting these devices and bridging different types of wireless networks is easy. You know, yep. Making these devices exchange meaningful information, that's hard. And there aren't, to the best of my knowledge, open standards for how a thermostat publishes information about itself to other devices. So are we not destined to be, even if not from a wireless communications point of view, destined to be locked into somebody's ecosystem just because of the data?
Yeah, I think that there's a great danger that does happen. I mean, as I say, AllJoin is working on that. They did announce kind of a new standard at the beginning of the year that sort of makes it available to address items remotely and to get data from them. But because there is such great variety, it's hard to do, which is why we're seeing the programs like Work with Nest, which basically a set of standards gets defined, and admittedly they're proprietary to Google, but then things can start to talk to each other. Probably the easiest thing is to give you a couple of examples here for Works with Nest.
Go on.
Whirlpool have a washing machine that will switch to a different cycle length depending on whether you're in the house or not, because it's more energy efficient and it knows that you don't need to have the washing done by a certain time. Equally well, it can delay a cycle during peak energy hours. That's tying in with the rush hour thing. And then there's another one, which is the BMW iDrive, that is a Works with Nest thing that knows where you are when you're about to come home. It will turn on your lights, it will turn up your heating and open your garage door for you. Now, that's all happening because the Works with Nest program is using the Nest as kind of the hub. It's nothing to do with actually the thermostat, and it's then able to make smart decisions on your behalf. And it's where the delegated decision part of smart living comes in. And I actually think that's where the value is, not in the kind of the remote control, which was kind of the big claim for the internet kettle and to a certain extent the internet fridge as well.
That's a good point you make, though. So that BMW iDrive system, that's fitted to BMW cars, and they are, I speak from personal experience, not particularly cheap. So what happens when, you know, your accessories, your home, your car, maybe even white goods, your entertainment system, you know, is overwhelmingly more expensive or valuable to you than the smart grid that it's connected to all the other devices? Because I don't think I would change my brand of car because it didn't talk to my thermostat. But I might be frustrated with my thermostat that it doesn't support my preferred brand of car, if you see what I mean. Because
I'd be more frustrated with your car manufacturer for being really slow and rubbish.
Well, but let's assume that BMW aren't slow and rubbish, because right now they're hooked up with Nest and it, you know, sings, it dances, it makes the tea. But I've just bought a Hive system. This is a hypothetical situation.
Okay, right.
You know,
that's the British Gas one, right?
Yeah, the British Gas one. But I've bought a competing product, or I've bought a Apple Home Kit-based platform.
I honestly, I think it will be a problem. It's going to be one of the limiting factors of smart home. The thing I would say is in most cases, there's more than one way to skin a cat. And in the case of a car, you can add something like automatic. That's another works with Mesh product that just plugs into the ODP2 socket in your car. It's kind of the computer on board your car and then can communicate with your smartphone around location. And actually, it's kind of smartphone, as it's all sensor loaded, is going to be really important.
Yeah, I do like the automatic product. That's really upset it's only available in the US, but it's kind of like a Fitbit for your car, isn't it, really?
It is, and that can actually provide really interesting information into this kind of smart living environment. But I think it is a problem that has yet to be really addressed because it, you know, is quite young, and that's why we've seen Apple do things like HomeKit, and it's, you know, you're going to have to live in the Apple ecosystem. But I would point out there's an interesting trend in the connected car space, and we've talked about Android Auto, CarPlay and Mirrorlink before. What we're actually seeing in reality is the car manufacturers are supporting all three of those standards, and now they're doing head units that will do CarPlay and Android Auto, and the
so you can choose your flavor.
And VW is a great example of that. So you choose your flavor. I suspect we'll see a certain number of products do that, and they'll be able to tie into multiple different ecosystems. Now, whether you get the premier experience on all of them is open to debate. What I particularly like, one particular product I saw, it was Resolve. They described it as a responsive light bulb.
Was this at CES?
And it was at CES. And
actually, in Las Vegas,
Claxon.
Thank you. And it actually changed the hue of the light bulb according to what the lighting conditions were outside in order to kind of match your circadian rhythm so you sleep better and all that kind of thing. Mm. So I do think there's genuine value to this, but I think you're absolutely right that it's going to take a while to happen. It feels like it's particularly problematic because there are so many different product life cycle lengths coming together. Your oven is going to be, you know, 10 years, fridge maybe 15 years, light bulb as well. It's either 6 months or, you know, be 5 years, depending on what you have.
It's interesting that the devices that have been successful so far are ones that seem to connect to smartphones or the internet directly. And so they're not hooked into sort of the hub unless it's your smartphone. And then the other ones are they tend to be low cost kind of consumer electronics devices with those relatively high replacement cycles you were talking about. So we've got, rather than the smart home where it's all kind of bedded into the fabric of the house, actually what you've got is lots of separate standalone plug-in shelf top desktop, you know, add-ins. You know, the Philips Hue light bulbs are fascinating because if you were designing a system that changed, you know, coloured lights and things, you wouldn't think of putting all the electronics and control mechanism in the light bulb, which is going to get disposed of. But, you know, of course, to a certain extent, they've had to do that just because it now needs to plug into a dumb light socket.
That's right. And actually brings up a more general point about this. Smart automation in the home has been around for a long time, but it's previously been something you kind of had to put in at build time. It was very expensive. There is this consumerization of the smart home with, I think, something like the Philips Hue light bulbs being a great example. And so in that sense, it is becoming a more open market and the possibility to do things. But the trouble is it's going to be very piecemeal. I mean, I've got some Philips Smart Hue light bulbs, but that's sort of the extent of most of the smartness in my home.
Can you switch your light bulb on right now?
I could if I wanted to.
Can we see that?
It's not a lot of point, really, because you won't be able to see the light bulb
go on. That's just cool, though.
And I've got a home weather system that's over Wi-Fi, but they don't talk to each other.
It's really cool. You open the curtain and then you look outside.
Yeah.
Now, this is just, it's the NetAtmo product that both inside NetAtmo.
NetAtmo, cool.
Has
right.
Both an inside and outside sensor box.
Well, what is the weather inside your house at the moment, Rafe?
Well,
does it tell you what the temperature is inside your house?
It actually tells you whether your environment is okay on a traffic light system, kind of green, orange, and red.
What is yours?
And that's based, mine's on orange, because I think the house is too cold, because I like a cool house about 15 degrees. And it will also measure the CO2 levels, will measure the sound levels, humidity. It does the same thing outside. But really what I want it to do, if it's particularly dark outside, turn on the Philips Hue light bulb a bit brighter or a bit earlier so I, you know, get woken up properly. That's not happening yet.
Okay, so that's a great opportunity to move on to trust, because here you are saying, I want my weather system to manage my light bulbs. And okay, I kind of get it, because I lived in a house once that had a built-in sort of smart home system, and the house had an external thermostat that was used to sort of adjust how quickly the place should heat up. It was cool. It was built in. But that problem there was that it only took the sensors overnight. And so, for example, I had these problems where where, for example, it might be very, very cold overnight and then warm up the next day, but the system had sensed, you know, done its sensing for the day and had set the heating system up, and maybe had, because this was all about electrical heating that sort of charged cells that discharged over the day. But the point there was that I ended up paying to heat my house when I didn't need to. And in the end, I actually sort of turned that feature off because it was better for me to sort of turn it up and down as I wanted.
So you had to do the thinking.
Well, it was...
I
de-smarted it because it wasn't as responsive as I wanted. Mm. And actually, it was making quite expensive decisions because particularly in the UK at that time, you know, electrical power wasn't a very cheap way to heat a house. There was other, better, probably better fuel options, but that was all that was available to me. And so I was anxious, really, about not managing my bill, because if you had 2 or 3 days where I didn't touch the thermostat, you'd expect the bill to be broadly the same. But of course, they could vary wildly because of this external sensor, which was boosting or not, you know, the heating.
If you take the assumption that dedicated decision-making is the value of smart living, which I think it is, you have to think about, well, what's the trust relationship? And, you know, some people might think, oh, maybe it's your operator or it's the supplier of your hub. And so in the case of Nest, you'll be someone like Google. Do I really trust them? You know, that's not a company that I kind of associate with massive amounts of security and wanting to make decisions for me.
Well, who's going to step in when it all goes wrong, though? If I buy a Nest and it either blows up my house or you know, ruins my heating system or costs me a fortune, like, you know, you can't say, oh, you've only got yourself to blame, because this is a product that somebody sold me, you know, that's done a terrible job.
Well, and once things go wrong and once the Daily Mail picks up that things have gone wrong, then we'll get some knee-jerk regulation.
Nest burnt my house down will be the headline.
Nest killed my pet by turning the heating up too high when I was out for the day.
And it's easy to joke about this and say it's kind of like the equivalent of people who are against the idea of horseless carriages and they're just Luddites. But actually there is a real problem here in that there's kind of an invisible brain making these decisions for you. And the first time it goes wrong, you kind of lose the trust in it.
The one I was interested in recently was the BMW i8, which, if you're not familiar...
Oh, the fancy, no. Nice one.
So of the two kind of hybrid electric cars that they've got, that's the sporty performance
one. Have we
one.
Got any listeners with an i8?
Or if you have, I want to come around your house and see it and go have a go.
Caress it.
But what it does, and it's kind of beginning to get towards connectivity, is... Because it's an electric hybrid, when you plan a route on the sat nav, it analyzes that route and decides which part of the journey will be driven on petrol, which part will be driven on the electric batteries, and when you're going to recharge. And it can also route according to, you know, where you want to refuel and all these sorts of things as well. And I think even the Teslas will do planning to take you past supercharger points and this kind of stuff. And that's all great. But if I spend, in the UK, an i8 is more than a £100,000 car. So if I spend that on buy a £100,000 car, and this one feature of it is about, you know, making it perform, because the whole idea here is that you get the optimum value, you get the eco savings that you need, and the performance, those sorts of things. If it starts making bad decisions, if it does, like, you know, the terrible sat navs used to, which would make a 5-minute journey into a 20-minute journey because they had terrible maps. You know, actually, what's my comeback? You know, I can't bring the vehicle back to BMW and say it's not a good car because it still drives. Yeah,
who's my trusted
core function?
Who's my trusted data supplier? Who's my trusted data store? Who's going to store the data? And then who's my trusted decision maker? I mean, I wonder, could you actually say, well, I prefer blah because I like the way they make decisions, or their decisions are based on X?
Because there are going to be certain styles of decisions, and I think this actually... It's kind of a chicken way to get out of this, but it's not smart if it's not making decisions better than you yourself are able to make the decisions. And a lot of it is around really implementational challenges and making it good enough. If you look at any piece of technology, and I think you know, the smart home and smart living is a good example of this, but you know, you can draw the analogy with sat navs or the usability of smartphones. Until it gets good enough, it doesn't go into the mass market, it doesn't get mass market acceptance. And I think the problem is, with smart home, there are so many disparate players and so much potential for it to go wrong, and actually so many personal preferences built into it as well, and so many different styles of living, it's going to be a much harder nut to crack. And so I think the analytics and big data and all of those fancy words will come into it, But there is still going to be this underlying trust problem, because I think humans are pretty irrational about these kind of things.
Can I try a quick question on you then, right? Just for data storage, because I think we know that. Who would you like to store and then maybe respond to your smart data, right? And this is a question for you. Do you want to have Google, Microsoft, et cetera, so a big .com, right? Do you want to have a startup, cool, funky .com company? NatWest, RBS?
Banks.
Or Vodafone.
Financial institutions.
Or Vodafone. Or
mobile operators.
Yeah.
I'm a techie, so I would go for a big .com, the Microsofts, the Googles. But I suspect some people would be a lot happier with the bank. So I wonder if they might not have a role to play in this space. I mean, I certainly don't trust the operator, and I certainly wouldn't put it on a startup simply because I don't trust them to not be around in 5 years.
Yeah, so I agree with Rafe. Definitely not startups. You need reliability and longevity.
Okay. Yeah.
Definitely not mobile operators. Just not their core business. They don't show an aptitude for it. Maybe the big firms and those sorts of things, because they are
the Googles
or the Apples of this world. I mean, they don't do a perfect job. But I think I disagree with you, Rafe. I don't think I want banks to do it, because I think that banks have such a crude risk model. You know, that I for example, this week I was trying to log into my internet banking and I had to have my two factors and my password and my key, and my battery was flat, and so I had to, you know,
secure though.
But I think for some people that is reassuring. I mean, I'd agree with you.
Yeah.
It would drive
very
me
annoying.
Mad,
but,
yeah.
but my point is that it's not a case that they can't do security. It's a case that all of their experience is doing security that minimizes the risk at the cost of the user experience.
Right.
And that, you know, banks don't have great track record in making it really easy to access your money. They're actually putting barriers in your way because it's a low frequency, it's a low frequency transaction, and you're prepared to have a lot of pain. I actually think that an Apple, for example, would be great at this, because although they won't get it perfect and there have been hacks, they and perhaps people like Google have this balance of usability and security.
Well, the accounts were hacked. The user accounts were hacked because of the passwords, not the Apple servers.
No, but they've had security issues in the past where things haven't been implemented well. But just, I think...
Do you trust Apple more?
I do, but let's be clear. That's only of that list of four that you gave.
Okay,
Do I wish that any of them would do it? No, I think I'd like somebody better than all of them to do it.
Yeah, and I think that's right. There is probably a chance for someone to come along and improve it, because let's face it, those technology companies have different priorities themselves as well.
Well, I think it's interesting that you didn't choose Vodafone there, and I did mention this at the start. I wanted to come back to the operators, and a good couple of years ago, there were many, many reports coming into my inbox as press releases saying there are going to be X billion devices by 20 blah, 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 and there was an assumption that every one of these devices, these connected devices, would have a SIM card in them. And I remember crossing my arms thinking,
Do you remember when all mobile banking was going to be secured by the things on the SIM card?
Yes, come on, please. I would like to kick the teeth in of the operators now by saying, metaphorically, yes, it's quite a lot of work kicking in the teeth of everyone working at, insert operator name, because I think it's a massive, massive missed opportunity. They just haven't got the connectivity together globally. I mean, I should be able to buy a global SIM, a connected SIM that works anywhere on the planet for $1 or whatever, and so my light bulb has a SIM card in it, but it'd be too flipping difficult now, right?
Don't get me wrong. We are still going to see
the market.
Lots of machine-to-machine SIMs. I think connected cars and things that move are the perfect example.
That's the limit. It stops there, right?
It does. But in the home and industry, why not use Wi-Fi or kind of local radio networks?
Well, there's not a why not. It's the other one that we will not use a SIM card.
But those devices, those things that you cited, Rafe, like the connected car, they're going to use a SIM card because they have to, because 3G and 4G networks are the only long-range mass coverage networks. No one is using the SIM as a special identifier for the device. No one's using the SIM for security, to the best of my knowledge. And so the car will use an IP connection, and all of its identity, authentication, security will be in the software.
It has to run a layer on top of that.
I would say there are going to be industrial applications where I think it is relevant, but I think the big point here is that operators have had an opportunity that they have yet again missed, because they've been more interested in other things. It will still be big. It will still be lots of money for them. But they kind of missed the boat.
Yeah,
and they're just going to be back to being connected living pipes or smart pipes between smart devices.
Indeed.
Okay, but we're kicking the operators. What better place to end it? Woo-hoo. As ever, thanks very much for listening. If you've got any thoughts, comments, or indeed if you own any of these smart living devices, let us know how you're getting on with them, because they're really difficult to review because you need to live with them, I think, to understand how they work well. You can reach us at the website, 361podcast.com, where you can leave a comment or find a form to email us. You are on the Twitters at 361podcast, or you can...
you can send us a letter.
Oh, you can send us a letter. I was going to say,
care of Mobile Inns Review.
Or you can go. Or you can. I was thinking you can go to the 361 podcast Facebook page and be amongst the very select few who have decided to follow us. But I struggle to endorse Facebook, so just use Twitter. It's easier. As ever, thanks very much, guys. Brilliant.
Oh, sorry, are we meant to say something?
You could just say you're welcome. You normally say you're welcome.
Yeah. Well, I love you. You lots of love.
Exactly. Yeah. Good.
Thank you, listeners.
Thank you very much for listening, and we will be back next week. Bye bye.